Recent research with beef cows has shown that what we feed the cow during gestation and early lactation can have a significant effect on lifetime progeny performance. This altered progeny performance caused by how we feed the cow has been commonly called fetal programming, lactational programming, or developmental programming. Most producers understand the need to have cows in the proper body conditions for it calving in the beginning of the breeding season, but often don't think much about how cow nutrition can impact things like lifetime progeny immune function, reproduction, and carcass characteristics. I'm Dr. Ron Lemonager, Beef Extension Specialist at Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor of Beef Magazine, based in Wheat Ridge, Colorado.
We have two very special guests today to talk about how lifetime progeny performance is affected by what we feed the cow. Our first guest is Dr. Amanda Blair, Meat Science Specialist from South Dakota State University, and Dr. Patrick Gunn, Consulting Nutritionist with Purina Land O'Lakes.
Let's begin this roundtable discussion by providing a little background on fetal programming. Amanda, start us off with a little history on this.
Sure, Bert. A lot of the research that we have in cattle, most researchers that I know really formed an interest in this, reading some research that has been conducted, epidemiological studies that were conducted by researchers, most of those in the 90s is really where this started. But what they did is they looked back at military and medical records. And one of the most famous studies that was looked at was called the Dutch Hunger Winter, where they looked back at this time point in history. And what occurred there is during World War II, there was an embargo on food transported into the Nazi-occupied western part of the Netherlands. And this embargo was imposed during the last 6 months of the war, so in the winter of 1944 into the spring of 1945. So this embargo, coupled with a severe famine in that area, led to daily rations being limited down to about between 400 and 800 calories per day per person. Now, you know, in today's society, we talk about 2,000 calories a day. So this is a severe restriction. And there were pregnant women that were exposed to this severe food shortage and had children during or shortly after this time period. And what researchers were able to do was go back into these records of these children born during or shortly after this event. And what they learned is that these children had lower birth weights, but they were also able to follow them into their adult lives, and they found that they had higher instances of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. So what they suggested is that these children had developed what's called a thrifty phenotype due to this limited nutrient availability during gestation. So they were essentially being programmed to deal with the environment that they were going to be born into. So if that maternal environment was signaling limited food, they were programmed to store fat or to be thrifty. We might think about this as an easy keeper in the cattle industry. But then when they grew up and food was plentiful, their thriftiness kind of resulted in these obesity and accompanying metabolic issues. So that's really where a lot of this work came from, is researchers studying past events and following humans into their adult lives to see how those gestational impacts affected them.
So how does that relate to our cow industry? I mean, that's kind of the precursor to kind of what we're talking about today. So how does that relate to us?
Sure. I think in the cattle industry, if we think about the gestational environment, sometimes that's something we just forget about. You know, we don't think so much about that developing calf. We're more worried about getting the cow, you know, into a condition, or we're worried about her being able to lactate and support the calf at side. But if we think about the highs and lows that our cows might encounter during gestation, these highs and lows could be related to her changing nutrient requirements. You know, we all know that those fluctuate through the year and what stage she's in. But there also might be swings in forage quality or quantity, changes in her diet depending on what feedstuffs are available. Or, you know, in different parts of the country, I know we've certainly seen our fair share of weather extremes and stress created by that. So these events that our cows might encounter, they're going to vary at different points in gestation. So as a researcher, I have an interest in really understanding how this might affect the developing calf. So, for example, what might happen if she loses a condition or part of a condition score during some time during gestation? There's also been work looking at different nutritional deficiencies of specific nutrients or global restrictions, some research looking at overfeeding. So if we really think about what our cows are encountering, again, we might only be thinking about that from the context of her body and her condition, but maybe not necessarily what's going on inside the uterus.
Patrick, let me follow up on that. I think a fairly common management practice for a pregnant cow is you just kind of feed her along for the first two trimesters, and then the third trimester you try to feed her up so her body condition is a little better when she calves. What does that change in feeding regime throughout the pregnancy, what does that do to that calf?
That's a great question. You know, I think we still have more questions than answers to a certain extent, but when you think about how that fetus is developed and when we look at it from, you know, first trimester, what the majority of the growth is like versus second and third trimester, you know, we've started to see a lot of data trickling, particularly out of South Dakota State with some of Dr. Weaver's work there. Looking at second trimester, we know nutrient restriction definitely has an impact on muscle accretion as well as marbling. We've seen some data in other species outside of the cattle industry that would suggest that nutrient restriction early on during development may have reproductive repercussions. And then when we get into third trimester, we think about, in particular, I think an area where we're starting to head more towards is looking at the health aspect. And you think about, you know, even in humans, what's the one thing that we're worried about when somebody has a baby early? Well, that's usually lung development. How thrifty they're going to be from a health and immune function perspective. And so as we look into third trimester, there a lot of data is starting to look at the healthfulness of these cattle, particularly I think we've seen a lot here in the last couple of years, but, you know, we've got better vaccination protocols and better nutrition in some instances than we've ever had, but yet we're still seeing huge respiratory outbreaks in the feedlot sector. So if we just think about how that calf develops in utero, anytime we insult that calf, theoretically, we could impact its performance long-term. But, you know, each individual trimester definitely has its pros and cons in terms of how we're going to actually insult that calf long-term.
So let's describe for our viewing audience, you know, we're not changing the DNA. We're really changing what some people refer to as the epigenetics, right? And how these genes are sequenced in terms of how they turn on, how they turn off, how they're regulated. So, you know, expand on that just a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think you couched it very well, Ron. Obviously, we're not changing the genetics. Once that sperm and that oocyte come together and we make an embryo, you know, the genetics are locked. What genes that calf is going to have for the remainder of its life is defined at that point. But like you said, the word epigenetics basically means on top of genetics. So while we don't change the genes, there's a lot of really good research that has shown time and time again that how we affect that cow and the development of that fetus can actually dictate whether or not those genes turn on at specific times at all. Or whether certain genes are upregulated or downregulated during certain points in life. So when we kind of hit those critical growth stages, it's possible that maybe that gene never does turn on, or maybe it turns on at a lesser rate than what we would ideally expect it to, or maybe it's over-exaggerated in terms of the amount of DNA it's pumping out at that point. So I think you captured it very well. We're not changing the genetics, and I think that's the most important thing to understand with this is that we're not changing the gene profile, but we are changing how those genes might be expressed, particularly when we start looking into a lot of the technologies that we have available to us in the purebred and seed stock sectors with looking at genetic profiling and gene-enhanced EPDs. I think it's very important to understand that all those can do is tell us what genes are available. It doesn't tell us what genes are available to be turned on or off. And so we kind of have to keep that in mind that, you know, how that calf was taken care of in utero may or may not allow for those enhanced genetic profiles to actually be realized.
And I might mention just, you know, on top of that, Patrick, I think you make a really good point. It's really about reaching the genetic potential that's there. You know, we've put all this effort into our genetic selection, but if we don't, you know, pre and postnatally ensure that we've maximized that genetic potential, we're not going to realize it. And Ron, you brought up this concept of epigenetics, and, you know, I think certainly, like Patrick said, we can affect the, you know, turning on or altering expression of the genes in that offspring of that individual. But with the epigenetic side of things, a lot of these, we're also starting to learn that these are heritable changes that can be passed down to subsequent generations. So there's been some work coming out that's talking about, you know, how this can affect, you know, the next generation and on down the line, and some interest in looking at, you know, longevity and generational studies. And I think that's a fascinating area to look at. It takes a long time in the beef industry to get that answer.
Well, I think one of the things that we probably ought to mention here is that during the course of gestation, the reproductive tissues, for example, start before 60 days after conception, right? And muscle, the number of muscle fibers and the size of the muscle fibers and all those kinds of things, kind of as we go through that gestational period, okay, it has an effect on that resulting offspring, okay, after it's born and as it moves through puberty in the case of heifers and bulls, as we move into the feedlot in terms of carcass quality and carcass characteristics. So it's a bigger deal than I think we have given it credit for in the past. The other thing that I guess I want you to comment on, but, you know, I think we used to think about, you know, if we're going to rough a cow during a segment of the year, all right, you know, let her maybe lose a little weight, that kind of thing. We always kind of thought about, the, you know, that second trimester. It kind of gets us out of the lactation, kind of right there after weaning time, you know, kick her out on corn stalks or kick her out on low-quality native winter range grass or whatever. And maybe we need to rethink that philosophy a little bit. You want to comment on that?
Sure, Ron, I can take a stab at that. I think that's in our research program and in my background on, you know, the meat science and muscle biology side, we've really kind of honed in on the second trimester because, like you said, that's kind of a time that, you know, traditionally, you know, producers might have been taught, you know, told that, you know, the cows requirements are low during this period, so they can lose a little weight, maybe lose a little condition, and we can bring her back. But and we really wanted to take a look at that because that's really where muscle development and muscle fiber development peaks, and we see the initiation of fat cell development. So, you know, somebody interested in the carcass side of things, those are two pretty critical tissues. You know, we don't want to see detriments to muscle or fat development from a carcass composition standpoint. So, you know, we've done some work to look at how, you know, cows in a restricted energy standpoint or if they're in a negative energy balance during that time, how does that affect the offspring? And a little bit of what we learned is that it really doesn't affect birth weight. That maybe is more critical in the later gestation time periods. But we did see a decrease in receiving weight. So at weaning, when we brought them into the feedlot, those calves were lighter that came out of cows that were in a negative energy status. Now that kind of got washed out by the end, no differences in final body weight or hot carcass weight. But we did, kind of one of the most interesting findings was we found an increase in the ratio of marbling to back fat. So in those calves that were from cows in a negative energy status, they had more marbling in relation to back fat. So that might argue that developmental time period was shifting the proportion of fat cells in different areas, and that may have a, you know, physiological reason behind that. Now, I don't know yet what that is, but I think it's really interesting. We saw a tendency for a decrease in back fat and an improvement in yield grade out of those calves. So from a carcass standpoint, this might sound great, but we also, and Patrick alluded to this, we also knew that there was other factors in play here. And we looked at the immune function, the immune status of those calves, just did a challenge to them with an egg protein. So it wasn't going to make them sick, but it would make their immune system react. And we did find that those calves that were from cows in a negative energy status at mid-gestation had a reduced response to that antigen. So that kind of argues that, you know, I don't know if the carcass benefits are worth that loss of immune function potentially. And there's definitely more work to do there, but I'd echo what Patrick said. I was just down at the Range Beef Cow Symposium, and there was a bullpen session. They were discussing how, you know, we've got all this, you know, new vaccines and better vaccines, but we see more and more health issues in the feedlot. So, you know, and that can be a whole myriad of factors, but something we need to think about.
You know, looking at the other side, at the replacement heifer aspect, and even looking on down the road, you know, as that heifer becomes a cow in the cow herd and has calves of her own. Any research that shows any difference there?
Yeah, I can chime in on this one, I think. You know, there's been probably less data on the cattle front. That, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of data in sheep realm, but for the most part replicate in some instances on cattle. But, you know, it seems that it doesn't really matter when we restrict nutrients to cows. We can impact the fertility and a lot of the indicator traits, if you will. So looking at ovarian function or the number of follicles or oocytes those ovaries contain, there's been a lot of research that suggests it doesn't matter whether it's early lactate or early gestation or late gestation or somewhere in between, we can ultimately impact the reproductive function of those offspring. And as Amanda alluded to earlier, you know, these aren't necessarily just a next generation issue. A lot of these traits can be passed on for multiple generations. Really, if you're in a situation where you're developing your own replacement females, you know, maybe inputs are expensive this year, or quality is low, or whatever it may be. And so, you know, we're going to try to cut some corners and, you know, try to cheapen up our out of pocket costs for this year. Well, unfortunately, if we're retaining replacement females, it may not just impact us on this calf crop. If we hold those replacement females back, we might be impacting the, you know, fertility and sustainability of the herd for the next 6, 7, 8 years in theory. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. And that's irrespective of male or female progeny. I think we got to keep in mind that, you know, we're not just impacting what those cows have this upcoming year. We're impacting potentially profitability of our herd for the next decade.
So is it as simple as energy and protein supplementation, okay, to maintain body condition score, or do you think it's more complicated than that from a nutritional standpoint?
Well, I think it, you know, data is not all-inclusive yet. North Dakota State has spent a lot of time looking at individual nutrients and some minerals. There's been some work out of Oregon State as well that's focused on that pretty heavily. And I think it's fair to say that we got to look beyond protein and energy. Obviously, those are the macro ingredients and nutrients that we worry about day to day on making sure the cows have it. But, you know, I think we got to keep in mind that every biological process uses minerals and vitamins in some way, shape, or form. And so anytime we're meeting the requirements of the cow across the board, theoretically, we're impacting that fetus and that cow in a negative manner.
Patrick, do you find that, you know, in your work, do you see that that's something that producers kind of, you know, maybe want to cheat on sometimes?
Oh, mineral is always an easy one for people to want to cheat on. You know, just on a price per pound, it's probably the most expensive thing we put in front of those animals, but you know, long before I started with my current role, you know, I always had the best dollar spent on a good mineral program because, as I said, you know, every biological process uses a mineral. And if we look at your out-of-pocket costs annually, you know, forage, whether it's you're paying for forage, your opportunity cost on the land, or however you want to look at it, that's really our most expensive input for that cow year in, year out. And vitamins and minerals are usually 10% or less in many instances. And so I think there's a lot of solid data out there that suggests that a good mineral program enhances the digestibility and the performance you get out of the forage that you have in front of those animals. So I think it's twofold. I think it's really hard to justify trying to save $30 to $60 a year on mineral when you've got so many other things that we could probably push the pencil to and maybe find better places to cut.
I sure would agree with that. I think it's more complicated than just a pure supplement energy or supplement protein. I think it's got to be a complete package. You know, up to this point, we've kind of been talking a little bit more about the fetal side of programming, but do you kind of think that there might be a lactational programming and that may come into play, like, you know, the effect on colostrum quality, for example, that first set of milk that those calves eat? You know, we've always thought of that as kind of being a passive immunity, but any comments on early lactation and its effect on the calf's development from a lifetime perspective? Research that was done back a couple years ago that calves that didn't have adequate colostrum, okay, intake right after they were born actually had more health problems way back out here in the feedlot phase. And that would suggest to me that maybe there's more than just the in utero development of that calf, that it may go beyond that, particularly in that early part of the calf's life when tissues are metabolically very active. And maybe we have some epigenetic effects there as well. Any comments on that from either one of you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's even before we really knew what fetal programming was. I mean, we can look here back into the 70s, and Dr. Larry Cora, when he was at Kansas State, did some really good work. Again, we didn't really know what fetal programming was or epigenetics or any of that stuff, but looked at kind of some nutrient restriction on cows during third trimester, and it was pretty cut and dry back then that when we cut back on calories for the cow herd, we were giving up not only calf production in terms of performance, but those cows were born lighter, they were less healthy. You look at colostrum quality, there's been some work out of Kansas State since then that's kind of identified that cows in some kind of a nutrient restriction situation have fewer IgGs, IgMs. So we know we can impact quality of the colostrum. You know, ultimately, we know first calf heifers are always going to be inferior in that regard to mature cows. But we know that sets the stage for the healthfulness of that calf. So anything we can do to kind of hedge in the direction of improved colostrum quality. But even beyond that, I think, you know, you can kind of take a page from the dairy literature and look at the myriad of milk replacers that we have out there in the dairy world. You know, they're really starting to focus on not just protein and energy, but really some of the ratios of fatty acids in those particular milk replacers. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, we're altering the content of the milk through the nutritional process, and so anything that we can do that might be making that milk better or poorer quality, even though we look at it in macros, you know, the dairy world's really starting to look at micro ingredients on a much stronger basis, and I think it's safe to say that, you know, what we do third trimester and early lactation is probably definitely affecting that milk production and quality and composition, ultimately changing calf growth.
So do you think that there's a difference between age groups? Okay, you know, you got replacement heifers, number one, then you got first calf heifers, and you got second calf heifers, and then you got mature cows. Do you think one group is more vulnerable to nutrient restriction than others?
Personally, and I'll let Amanda chime in here too, but you know, as I kind of said before, you know, we know our first calf heifers are always the ones who are going to have the poorest quality colostrum, and that's just because they haven't been through the process of making milk before. But, you know, I look at the growth curves and the energy and protein requirements of those growing animals. I mean, not just our first calf heifers, but even our 2-year-olds coming 3-year-olds. still haven't probably matured out in terms of weight and growth curve. So, you know, don't know if there's a lot of data to support it, but personally, I would really believe that our first calf and second calf heifers are probably more suspect to having larger problems associated with fetal programming, if you will, just because a little bit of a change or a little bit of a restriction there might look a lot more severe than a little bit of a restriction on a mature cow.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that, Patrick. There's data out there that would show, there was a study done where they restricted cows or cows and heifers in this group of research cattle, and they restricted energy and protein to them, and found that a much higher percentage of the calves that were from the younger cows were susceptible to what we call intrauterine growth retardation. So this would be classified by a decrease in fetal weight and an increase in organ weights as a proportion. So more of those nutrients were being shunted to the organs, the brain, the heart, but the entire weight of the fetus was reduced. So we definitely see those. Some of that work also, and maybe you'd want to comment on this, they found a decrease in cotyledon weight, so that placental development was severely restricted. But again, more so in those younger cows than the older cows. It seemed like the older cows were being able to buffer that to some extent, and it goes back to what you said about, they're still trying to, the young cows are still growing themselves.
And I think that cotyledon weight thing is a big deal, okay? That whole uterine development, okay, that supports that calf from a nutrient flow and obviously excreting of, waste products and that kind of thing. And that blood flow has got to be there for that calf to be able to thrive and allow it to reach its genetic potential. Any last comments from either one of you about anything we missed that we need to talk about in this area of fetal programming, lactational programming, developmental programming that we've missed?
I maybe just comment. I'm excited at the opportunity to visit with you guys on this conversation. And I think from my standpoint, Patrick alluded to this, there's a lot to learn out there about this topic. We've really just scratched the surface. The swine guys and the sheep, they've got shorter gestations and different scenarios. But they've moved a little farther down the path in some regards to studying this. But I think it's really important for beef producers to have an appreciation for the developmental processes that are going on at specific times, and really think about or consider how these any alterations to maternal nutrition could affect the offspring. I think just an understanding of it and maybe not just, relying back on, a fetus is really small, so we don't need to worry about it at that time. I think that's really critical to ensuring that we don't have any of these major detriments.
I guess from my perspective, I'd like to echo what Amanda said. I definitely appreciate the opportunity to join in on this conversation with you guys. And we see and hear about this a lot, and I think this conversation is very much going to be ongoing because, as Amanda said, there's a lot that we don't know. I would like to think that one of the places we're going to be able to get to is what do we do to intervene when we know a cow has been restricted in some way, shape, or form. Is there any way to recapture that genetic potential on that calf moving forward? And that's a question I receive a lot is, okay, so I bought this group of cows and I know we had some problems nutritionally. Is there anything we can do to overcome that? And, I guess I'm excited that I'm young enough. I'll be in the industry for a long time and we'll get to a point where maybe we can overcome some of those shortcomings when we get into some bad weather or less desirable situations from a maintenance cow perspective. I think we really hit on tons of high points today. It's, like anything, every operation is going to be a little bit different in how we're going to tack this and have the conversation about programming moving forward.
Well, Patrick, maybe ask you a quick question just from a nutrition standpoint. A lot of times we focus on the negative, what happens if we restrict or this nutrient's limiting or something like that. And a lot of, I think what we do on research is maybe to help keep us out of the ditches. I mean, we're in the infancy of this, I think. But what excites you in terms of moving forward from a nutrition standpoint? How can we use this to promote positive changes?
Good question. I guess I haven't thought about it in that way exactly. But, you know, I think, if nothing else, I think we're getting a heightened awareness that, you know, this is not a made-up phenomenon, right? We know there's something to it. So, you know, looking long-term, I really think, you know, even though beef cattle are developed in an extensive environment, a lot of times it's round bales in a feeder or native grass through the winter. I think we're starting to see enough value in proper nutrition that I really think, honestly, you know, long-term, nutritionally, I see us moving a little bit more of the way of the dairy industry. You know, we're not going to feed everything in TMRs, and I get that, and I don't think anybody's ever going to be set up for that nationwide. But I really do think we're going to start focusing on more micronutrients, long-term, you know, specific ratios of vitamins and minerals, maybe even get as far down as to amino acid supplementation or specific fatty acids that we know have a benefit. I think on the human side, we've seen a lot of that, you know, specific fatty acids for brain development and things like that. And I think there's some opportunities long-term for that. A whole lot of research needs to be conducted first, obviously. But I think long-term, you know, that's something that gets me excited day-to-day is that, you know, we've kind of gotten past the idea of, you know, we got to have protein energy. I think everybody knows that. But it's, you know, as we have a lot of guys spending five figures on replacement bulls and a tremendous amount of time, labor, resources, money, whatever you want to look at into developing replacement females, with the amount of effort we're putting into genetic selection, what can we do to really optimize the genetic potential of those calves? And obviously that starts with conception.
We'd sure like to thank Dr. Amanda Blair and Patrick Gunn for being our guest experts today. Please join us again next month when our beef roundtable discussion will delve into the topic of how does the U.S. beef industry compare to the global beef industry in terms of sustainability.